It's a pleasure to introduce Sarah Chezies. Has anybody actually met her before? If I can just ask informally, Sarah is very new to Toronto. Her and her husband moved here in the summer. Her husband is the assistant rabbi right here at Sher Shemayim, and Sarah is teaching at Olpana. She's also a Yoetzet Halacha, the graduate in the program in Nishmat. For the last number of years, 3 years, they were at Yale University, her and her husband, as part of the JLIC, Jewish Learning Initiative on Campus, I believe it stands for. And I think she's a young, upcoming, dynamic scholar, and it's a pleasure to welcome her officially in the city, and we look forward for many years of engaging in Torah study and Lakasha. And I'll leave, so I'll let it be, all the women can talk on that. It's a very important subject. I don't have to tell you what's going on.
Thank you. Before I begin, while you're still in the room, I'd like to thank Rabbi Kelman for inviting me to speak here today. I'm very honored to be speaking alongside scholars from Israel and America, and I'm very inspired to see that so many of you chose to spend your Sunday here learning Torah and engaging with discussions about Judaism. Since we moved to Toronto about 4 months ago, I've really been taken aback by the vibrancy of this community, the opportunities for chesed and for Torah learning, and I'm so thrilled to have joined this community and look forward to, as Rabbi Kelman said, many more opportunities to learn together in the future. Thank you. The mikvah has been in the news a lot recently. Unfortunately, the rise in articles about this mitzvah has stemmed from the alleged accusations against a prominent rabbi in Washington, D.C. on voyeurism in the mikvah. And as difficult as this has been for our community, there have been, I think, two positive things that I have seen come out of all these articles and discussions on Facebook and different online news magazines. The first is that the flood of articles about the mikvah attest to the fact that people care about the mikvah and care deeply about it and are very personally invested in this mitzvah. And the second is that people of all denominations, Orthodox, Reform, Conservative, Reconstructionists, have all chimed in about discussions about how their mikvahs are run and how they see mikvah running in their community. And neither of these two facts should be taken for granted. In Total Immersion, a mikvah anthology, are any of you familiar with it? Okay. It's a mikvah anthology put together by Rivka Slonim, different articles. And there's an article by historian Joshua Hoffman, who writes about the history of the mikvah in America. And he explains that while the earlier generations to the U.S. did use the mikvah, the next generation neglected this mitzvah entirely. He cites three main reasons for why this was so. Can you guess any of them? Yeah. Yes. So the first one he writes is they were dirty. You know, many mikvahs were actually shut down by the local health authorities for being so unsanitary. Any other thoughts? Okay, so that's a good one. He doesn't write it, but that's probably true also. So he says that one was women weren't educated about the mitzvah and might have thought the modern bathtub can just do what the mikvah of the original mikvah was supposed to do. And thirdly, you know, which I think we all intuited, is that the concept of tahara mishpacha, of ritual purity, was just outdated, especially to the Reform Jews in American early history who were seeking to modernize and rationalize Judaism. He gives two additional reasons, which was, you know, not wanting to mark something so private in a public bathhouse, and also the cost of building a mikvah. So to counteract some of these challenges, Rabbi David Miller in the 1930s published a pamphlet of how to build a mikvah in your home. He was under he used different halachic guidelines and thought that you can actually tap into the city's water source to build a mikvah. So he, if you Google it, you can find there's like pictures of, I tried to put it on a source sheet, but my Google Docs wouldn't allow me to put an image on it. But there's a picture of, you know, how you can disguise the mikvah as like an end table or like behind the sofa, and you know how you could have a mikvah in your home that would be cost effective and private and hopefully clean if it's your own house. So this was the dire state of mikvah in 1930s in America. Mikvah use began to rise after World War II with the, you know, the influx of immigrants from Europe who were still holding on to this mitzvah, and began to flourish more in the 1960s with the Baal Tshuva movement, and till today has continued to rise in popularity. In the contemporary times, there has been a real rebirth of the mikvah. Mikvahs are seeing renewed interest in their use, and while it's still somewhat mysterious and secretive, the mikvah is being spoken about much more widely. When I worked, as Raquel mentioned, we just most recently came from New Haven, where I worked at Yale University, and I was pleasantly surprised that the Reform rabbi on campus was very involved in mikvah for our community, and we, you know, partnered together to do educational programs on the mikvah in New Haven, something that, you know, would never have happened 20 years ago. And many of the talks that I have given on the mikvah or on nidah, there's been a woman who came up to me after the class and said, I've either never used the mikvah or I used it years and years ago, and I'm thinking about, you know, either start using it for the first time or using it again. Can you remind me what to do? And, you know, we had a discussion about it. So today I'd like to talk about what has contributed to this renewal of the mikvah and how modern Jews of the 21st century can relate to this mitzvah. We'll begin by exploring together what the mikvah was used for in biblical times and delving into possible meanings behind this mitzvah. We'll then discuss what new developments of the modern era have enhanced our understanding of and appreciation for this mitzvah and how it's observed in contemporary times. And then and feel free to ask questions, comments along the way. While today the mikvah is used routinely by women, conversions before Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah, and brides and grooms before their weddings, in the times of the Beit HaMikdash, the mikvah was part of everyday life. The mikvah was used when anyone entered a state of tum'ah, which is like spiritual impurity, to exit that state and enter a state of tahara, a spiritual purity. So what exactly is tum'ah? And how does immersing in a mikvah usher in a state of tahara? I'd like to gain a better understanding of what tum'ah is by looking at the various instances of tum'ah in the Torah and pulling together a theory of what all of these can have in common. So before we turn to the source sheet, what examples of tum'ah can you think of? Who in the Torah becomes tameh? Anyone know? Okay, so one of them is contact with a dead body. That's in source number 4, if you want to skip there, where it says, Hanogeya b'meit, b'chol nefesh azam, b'temeh shivat emim. So if you touch a dead body, you become tameh for 7 days. And more than that, it goes on to say not just the dead body itself, but kol haba al ha'ohel, like anyone who is under the same overhang as a dead body becomes tameh. Anything else? Okay, so we'll read through them. So one is in source number 1. It talks about the occurrence of tzara'at, which is some sort of skin discoloration. V'ra'a koyen nega ba'or ha'basar b'se'er ba'nega ha'fachavan. So he sees this certain, I guess it's translated as plague, a certain thing on the skin where, you know, it turned a certain color. And he goes on to say, if it's a certain color and a certain size or whatever, the Kohen declares it tameh. So some sort of skin disease called tzara'at. In source 2, we have the pasuk about both a man and a woman who have a certain bodily emission. So in source 2 in Vayikra, Pasuk Bet, Tzabru b'nei Yisrael v'matonai lehem, ish ish ki yazav mitzaro zovo tamehu, a man who has an issue from his body becomes tamei. And yitze isha ki tiyazava dam yazava bivsara, one who has a flow of blood. Shivat yamim tiyav nitza becomes nitza for 7 days. The kohen agabai tuma arev, and her petetus becomes tamei. This is the one we're most familiar with today, is the nitza. So we have the mitzora, the, you know, translated sometimes as leprosy, but I'm not sure that's the best translation. The mitzora, the man or woman who has an emission, a dead body. And also we have in source 3, the woman who gives birth. Daber b'nei Yisrael, emoi shaki tezriya b'nei da'azachar, woman who gives birth to a baby boy, shamashivat yamim, becomes tamei for 7 days, and for a baby girl it's 14 days. So what are, again, last one, in verse 5, source 5, in Vikra Lamed Hey, is ko asher yipom nivotam alav yitama. So certain animals, or like bugs and things like that, that have died, engender tuma, and someone who touches them becomes tamei. So anyone who experienced any of these above scenarios was considered tamei. They were prohibited from engaging in certain activities of kedusha, of holiness, and from entering the Beit HaMikdash. Until the person immersed in a mikvah, a spring, or a cistern of water. So based on these examples, what can we determine is the reason behind this mitzvah of tuma and tahara, and why these particular things causing tame and tahara? So before we explore answers to this question, it's important to point out that the Torah doesn't tell us, right? The Torah doesn't tell us the reason for tuma and tahara. And in fact, the Midrash in Source 6 says it quite clearly when it says, the dead body does not defile and the water does not cleanse. Rather, God said, I've issued an order and made a decree and no man can violate my decree. Right? The Midrash is telling us, you know, it's not, there's nothing inherently problematic. It's just a gzera. It's what Hashem said. At the same time, Rav Soloveitchik, in an essay entitled May We Interpret Chukim, Chukim are traditionally the mitzvot that have no apparent reason, like kashrut. He says, when it comes to these mitzvot, there are three potential questions we can ask. Why, how, and what? He says we can't ask the question of why. Why can't we eat milk and meat together? Why can't we wear a garment mixed of wool and linen? We could also not ask how, by what mechanism exactly does sprinkling the ashes of the Parah Aduma, the red heifer, make somebody tahor? We can ask the question of what. What meaning can I find in this mitzvah? What meaning does keeping kosher bring to my life? How does keeping shatnez, not mixing well and linen, make me a better person? So I don't claim that we're going to talk about the reason for tuma and tahara, just a reason behind the mikvah that can bring meaning to our lives. So we're going to look at two approaches. And let's first look at the Rambam's approach in Source 7. So the Rambam, Maimonides here, in the Guide for the Perplexed, Mor Nebuchim, divides the 613 mitzvot into different categories. He tries to give some reasoning, some meaning behind them. So in chapters 35 and 47, he speaks about the mitzvot relating to tum'ah. So in chapter 35, he writes, the 12th class comprises the laws concerning things unclean and clean. Meaning, I don't like the translation unclean and clean, but that he means, you know, spiritually impure or pure, tum'ah and tahara. Unfortunately, it's been turned as clean and unclean. The general object of these laws is, as will be explained by me, to discourage people from frequently entering the sanctuary, meaning the Beit HaMikdash, in order that their minds be impressed with the greatness of the sanctuary and approach it with respect and reverence. So then he elaborates further in chapter 47. For this reason, the unclean were not allowed to enter the sanctuary, the Beit HaMikdash, although there are so many kinds of uncleanliness that at any time, only a few people are actually clean. For even if a person does not touch a beast that died of his own accord, You can scarcely avoid touching one of the eight kinds of creeping animals, the dead bodies of which we find at all times in houses, thankfully not anymore, in food and drink, and upon which we frequently tread wherever we walk. And this serves to keep people away from the sanctuary and to prevent them from entering it whenever they liked. By such acts of reverence for the sanctuary will continue, the right impression will be produced, which leads man, as intended, to humility. So according to the Rambam, the point of the institution at Tum'ah is to limit the frequency at which we can enter the Beit HaMikdash. By limiting access to the Beit HaMikdash, we can more easily maintain our respect for this holy place and the humility that it engenders when we feel awe upon entering this place of Kedusha. As we all know, the more familiar we are with something, the less we're able to tap into the specialness that it has to offer. I remember the first time I went to the Kotel. And I was very excited to go, and I got there. You can just like feel the Kedusha emanating from that area of the Kotel. I had the opportunity to live in Israel for a few years. And then, it was harder to tap into that awe each time I went. I remember particularly being disturbed by local Yerushalmites with on her cell phone, like right next to the Kotel, but I understand where she's coming from because she probably goes there every day, right? And the more you're familiar with something, the more engenders feelings of comfort and not awe. So, but why were these particular things chosen according to the Rambam? They're not clean or unclean. They're not bad. They're just common. Right. According to the Rambam, these were chosen because they were part of everyday life in biblical times, at least. So they are, since they're common things, there's always, according to him, dead bugs everywhere in your homes. They accomplish the goal of limiting the times that we could enter the Beit HaMikdash and help us maintain our reverence for it. Well, this exact meaning is difficult for us to relate to, as we no longer observe all of these laws of Tum'ah, and unfortunately do not have the Beit HaMikdash, I think the underlying message is still relevant for us today. The concept of Tum'ah reminds us that we need limits in our lives. In an age where almost everything is accessible at the click of a button, we need to consciously set boundaries for ourselves. I just wrote an article in the New York Times entitled, "Are Gadget-Free Bedrooms the Secret to a Happy Relationship?" Anyone see the article? It came out like last week. So it discusses the importance of consciously putting limits on cell phone use and iPad use and tablet use when you're with your partner. So they quote one researcher as saying, "Engaging in technology separate to a partner while in the presence of them encourages a disconnection rather than a connection." And I'm sure I definitely relate to that. I'm sure we can all relate to that in some ways. So limiting the use of technology allows spouses to focus on each other and give each other their undivided attention. As Orthodox Jews, we believe that by following the Torah's guide for limits and boundaries, we're able to sanctify ourselves. Limiting our diets to kosher food, for example, elevates the act of eating to something more holy. Similarly, a marriage is sanctified through the use of the mikvah. Through putting limits on intimacy, we're able to sanctify it. Setting boundaries for the times that couples can and cannot be together can also enhance the relationship by keeping romanticism alive. And this is what is found in source number 8. There's a famous statement by Rabbi Meir, who asks the question of why we have Nida. So Tanya Hayari Rabbi Meir Omer. Rabbi Meir says, why do the Torah say a woman should be Nida for 7 days? Because he gets used to her, disgusted by her, perhaps more like bored. Amrat Torah, to hate Tnei Ashivat Yamin, the Torah says, let her be Nida for 7 days. So she should be beloved to her husband as the day they entered the marriage canopy. So the advice of Rabbi Meir you know, sometimes rings true, sometimes not. As a Yotzer Halacha myself, I know that Nida does also bring in a lot of tension and problems in a relationship. At the same time, I have spoken to many women who have attested to the fact that keeping the laws of Tarei Mishpacha and Nida and Mikvah have enhanced the relationship with their spouses. And this advice is in fact given by many modern therapists today. They taught, you know, sometimes depending on what a couple is going through, a couple's therapist may encourage times of separation, times when you are together, when you're not together, in order to help the intimate relationship in a positive way. There's a therapist, Esther Perel, who writes about how to maintain what she calls a passionate marriage throughout our lifetimes, and talks about the need for maintaining your separate identities and your separateness, whether that's through your own hobbies, your own things, independent of your partner, in order to remind each other that you're separate people, that you're some sort of mysterious thing about the other person that you don't necessarily know about, to keep this passion alive. So she puts it well when she says, in order to keep the flame's desire burning, we have to remember that fire needs air. So one way to understand Tum'ah is as an institution of limits and boundaries, which we can apply to our marriages today. A second approach is offered by Rabbi Aryeh Kaplan in his book, The Waters of Eden. Any of you familiar with the book? Okay. So to fully appreciate his approach, let's first look at places in the Torah that entail immersion in a mikvah without being tamei first. As I have mentioned before, it's cases where you are tamei. In order to exit that stage, you have to become tahor through a mikvah. There are other places where the Torah talks about purifying ourselves with water without being one of those cases first. Can you think of any examples that you know about? What? Okay, excellent. So I didn't bring that source inside, but that's what I wanted to bring. The Kohen Gadol, the Kohen on Yom Kippur, is constantly immersing in a mikvah, changing his clothes between all the different acts that he's doing. Other ideas?
Before Yom Kippur?
I spoke about the Kohen Gadol does that now before Yom Kippur, and nowadays we have the custom for a lot of men who go to the mikvah before Yom Kippur. Great. Okay. What? Okay, so I think hand washing is probably it's very similar to this idea of Tum'ah, and well, remind me to get back to that a little bit later, because that's not a mikvah per se, but definitely some sort of ritual purification of our hands with water. Because if you look at source 9, this was in, not this week's parsha, the parsha before. After the incidents of Dinah and Shechem, Hashem tells Yaakov to return to Beit El, and he says in Pasuk Bet, V'yomar Yaakov el Beito ve'al kol asher imo, hisiru et elokei hanechar asher b'tochachem. So before they go back to Beit El, Yaakov commands his family to remove these foreign gods, to remove these idols that are amongst you. V'hita haru, and purify yourselves. V'hachlibu simutam, change your clothes. So in order, before they get rid of their idols, apparently they had idols with them, so they have to get rid of their idols and undergo a purification process, presumably with water. We'll get back to this in a little bit, how this fits in. In source 10, we read about not just the Kohen on Yom Kippur, but just the initiation of the Kohanim in the first place entails a purification of water. It says in Shmo and Parshat Tetzaveh, Pasuk Aleph, Zehadavar Asher Tasa Lahem, Mekadesh Otam LeKohen Li. This is what you have to do in order to sanctify the Kohanim to serve me. It goes on to say to bring a certain korban. Then in Pasuk Dalet it says, Ve'etz Aharon Ve'etz Banav Takriv Petzach Ohel Moed, bring Aharon and his son to the opening of the tent of meeting. Ve'rachas Otam Maim, wash them in water. Right? So in order to become Kohanim, They have to purify themselves with water. Another one I didn't bring a source for is before Matan Torah, when the Jewish people are receiving a Torah at Har Sinai, they're told to cleanse themselves, separate from their wives, and undergo a purification process. So with this background of these instances of Tahara, I'd like to turn to Rabbi Kaplan, where he says in Source 11. So he writes here that things that cause ritual defilement are primarily associated with death. So we had seen other causes of uncleanness are things associated with man's imperfection. So we had seen before that the dead body, or if you're under the underpass of a dead body, brings about tum'ah, and the dead body is called the av ha-tum'ah, like the main engendering of the state of tum'ah. The tzara'at, the skin disease, in some way is the skin dying of some sort. And the woman, after her monthly menstruation, is a loss of potential life that she had that month. So one question is how this theory of death fits into the yobadet, the woman who gives birth, which seems to be the opposite of death. Like, why should she become tamei? Any ideas, thoughts about it? So what, yeah.
She won't be able to have a child for another year or two.
Oh, that's interesting. Especially if she's nursing. It's like the way they used to nurse, probably more like four years or so after giving birth. If you like nurse frequently enough. I haven't heard that before. That's a very fascinating. Yeah. Yeah, so right. So one is like she lost the life inside of her, you know, even if she created a life, but she, her own body experienced the loss of that life. And along those same lines, one reason that I've heard for idea behind being tamei for 14 days versus 7 days when a woman gives birth to a girl versus a boy, that she loses not only the female baby inside of her, but also the potential life that that female baby carries with her as well. Another idea is offered by Rabbi Yehuda Henkin. He is the father, the husband, Rabbi Nidchana Henkin, who comes here to Toronto, I think, every summer, and who runs Nishma, where I studied. He's a fascinating idea about the Yoladet. So that's in Source 12. Where he writes, in the same way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu does not die, he is not born either. Not only death stands in contradiction to the idea of the eternal creator, but the continuity of generations in its entirety, birth and death as one, stand contradicting his eternity. May he be blessed. This is why the postpartum woman is Tamei'ah. Right, so it's not about necessarily death, and more about mortality, encountering the fact that we are mortal beings, that we need to be born, and we die, engenders this idea of tum'ah as being separate from God, who is eternal. And Rabbi Kaplan explains that this is why Yaakov and his family had to purify themselves after removing the idols, right? Because what is idolatry? It's making these immortal objects these man-made things have some sort of godliness, some sort of immortality. So when we, not fully comprehending or being aware of our own mortality vis-a-vis God's immortality, engenders a state of tum'ah requires some sort of tahara process to get out of it. So, and then according to Rick Kaplan, when we connect to death, or to mortality more broadly, to the finitude of life, we can't enter the mikdash. We can't enter the space of the eternal God who represents eternality and immortality. Yeah?
So I can understand all these situations where you need to purify, but I don't understand the length of time for women as opposed to men. Like, if men have an initiative, it can be, I do right away. And for women,
So in the biblical times, men also had to wait. Yeah, they did. Yeah. So in that times, everyone had to wait. Nowadays, the only one really observe the way it's supposed to be observed is the women. So I think because most of the rules relating to Tum'ah and Tahara are mainly related to the Mikdash, which we don't really relate to. The reason we still have the concept of women going is because there's a separate prohibition for a woman who is a nidah to be intimate with a man, and that prohibition remains as long as she does not go to the mikvah. So even though we don't have the ritual side of it about the mikdash, the prohibition side of it still remains. That's why women still go. And men still go for, you know, for Yom Kippur or other reasons, but not, they're not fulfilling the actual mitzvah the way it's supposed to be fulfilled in the Torah. That's a great question. So with this understanding of Tum'ah as related to death and mortality, Rabbi Kaplan goes on to say that what the mikvah then symbolizes. So he writes, going back to source 11, the second paragraph, seen in this light, we see that the mikvah represents the womb, the water of the womb. When an individual enters the mikvah, he is re-entering the womb, and when he emerges, he is as if born anew. Thus, he attains a completely new status. The water at the mikvah is not just any womb, but he goes on to say it's the womb of creation. When a person immerses in the mikvah, he's placing himself in the state of the world yet unborn, subjecting himself totally to God's creative power. The Torah speaks about the rivers running through Gan Eden, right? And he develops this idea that the waters of the mikvah, they're often called mayim chayim, like living waters, somehow tap into this original creation, the idea of Gan Eden, this pristine world of total potentiality. And so when we immerse ourselves in the mikvah, we tap into that total beginning of going back completely to creation, to Gan Eden, and help us recreate ourselves and help us have a new, fresh rebirth beginning. And he goes on to say that in order to renew ourselves, we have to humble ourselves. He continues to say, Mayim, right, which means water in Hebrew, shares the same root as the word ma, which means what. When a person immerses in water, he is nullifying his ego and asking, what am I? Ego is the essence of permanence, while water is the essence of impermanence. When a person is ready to replace his ego with a question, then he's also ready to be reborn with his answer. An idea in Chassidut that immersion is called tefillah is related to the word for bitul, tefillah bitul, which means nullification. So in order to have this renewal of tefillah, of connecting to the eternal God, we have to nullify our own egos. And the concept of mikvah as renewal and rebirth, I think, is very accessible to us today in modern times. It can be very meaningful to couples at different times in their relationships. While the average woman may not connect to a menstrual period as a loss of life, women trying to conceive often do, in fact, see the loss of life that is entailed in this process. For many, the realization that this month's egg has failed to fertilize, failed to bring about new life, is an encounter with death. It involves a mourning process of what could have been but is not. This is especially relatable for couples after a miscarriage. So I've personally counseled many couples after early miscarriages, and they're definitely experiencing a certain mourning period of the loss of life that they experience, even if it's only 4, 5, 6 weeks of life. And this is only exacerbated in couples undergoing fertility treatments, including IVF, in which the disappointment associated with a failed treatment is deep and very painful. For women experiencing any of these, the mikvah can be a really powerful experience, and I've heard that from many women. As Rabbi Kaplan says, the living waters of the mikveh offer a new beginning, a fresh start, another opportunity. And many women, you know, it's tricky when you're undergoing IVF when exactly to immerse in the mikveh along that period. But a lot of women, even if they don't technically have to immerse in a mikveh before the egg is implanted, they want to, right? Because the mikveh for them is sort of like, it represents a new beginning, a fresh start, and they want to have that experience before the new round of IVF is started. And I don't think it's a coincidence that the word for mikveh is so similar to the word for hope, with its tikva. And for a lot of women, the mikveh, it carries with it, with the freshness of the water, a new hope and a new beginning. And women coming to the mikveh after difficulty conceiving can certainly understand the value of humility that Rabbi Kaplan speaks about. It's truly humbling when you realize that we have progressed so far in the field of medicine. The mysteries of how life begins is still so far from our ability to totally grasp. You know, as much as we've learned a lot about it, there's still, you know, 10% of cases of infertility that are undiagnosed without any understanding of what's going on or how to treat it exactly. You know, when I was a biology major in college and I took a class in embryology, like every day I walked out just like more and more fascinated by the fact that we are born and that we're normal and that we function. You know, the mysteries of life is just so beyond, I think, a human grasp that, you know, I just walked out feeling so humble each time. And you know, I think given our lack of control and understanding what we can, how much control we have, we are really faced with our mortality, right, our own limitations. And immersing in the mikveh can be really uplifting and a source of renewal and hope. And we listed earlier several other people in the Torah who purified themselves without becoming tamei first, right, the Kohen, Bnei Israel before receiving the Torah. And these instances as well, the people involved were undergoing a change in role, a new beginning, a new sense of whether the Kohen becoming, Aaron becoming a Kohen, Bnei Israel becoming this Am Kadosh to Hashem. And for this reason, the mikveh is the last step of the conversion process. Now, when the person emerges from the water, he or she is a new person, a new member of Klal Yisrael. And some modern mikveh users have furthered this idea and expanded the use of mikveh to other experiences of renewal. There's an innovative mikveh in Newton, Massachusetts, where my mother-in-law volunteers, called Maim Chaim. Are any of you familiar with it? So it encourages both men and women to immerse in the mikveh at crucial junctures in their lives, such as breaking up with in a bad relationship, whether it's a dating relationship or a divorce, and finishing your last round of chemotherapy, you know, starting a new career, and you know whether these practices are encouraged in our communities or even allowed in our mikvahs, I think that message is clear. You know, that the modern times, the mikvah is a very powerful symbol of rebirth and renewal for ourselves and for our relationships.
I wondered if you've heard of the use of mikveh after rape.
So I think this mikveh is definitely, those are the kinds of things that it encourages. When someone goes to trauma, you know, especially to such rape or other things, to use the mikveh as a ritual that, you know, we believe that in Judaism, the physical rituals we engage in affect our own emotions, your own psyche, right? So engaging this ritual of immersion in a mikveh can be a very rejuvenating experience for them. So I think, you know, I wouldn't encourage you to go to the mikveh here in Toronto because I'm not, you know, I think these are new kinds of practices and people feel more or less for or against them. In terms of, you know, whether we should stick to the original purpose of the mikveh or expand it. But I think for the non-Orthodox, this has been very appealing to expand it beyond just the woman every month or for Yom Kippur or Rosh Hashanah. And so far I've spoken about the meaning behind the mikveh and its of tum'ah and some modern understandings of finding the meaning in the mikveh. In addition to the inspiration that many women feel from the mikvah, other modern developments have led women to re-embrace this mitzvah in modern times. I'd like to highlight three of them. The first is that unlike the dirty mikvahs of yesteryear, mikvahs today are clean and some are truly beautiful. There's even a new trend to make the mikvah into a spa. I'm not sure if you have any of these spa mikvahs in Toronto, but I brought you excerpts from an article describing one mikvah in the Upper East Side of Manhattan in Source 13, where it describes descending a grand spiral stair at the newly opened Jacques and Hannah Schwab mikvah on Manhattan's wealthy Upper East Side. Cohen was met by attendant offering fine towels from Israel. Then it was on to the prep room, fragrant with vanilla-scented candles, floored in Chinese tile, furnished in red cherry, and featuring an 8-jet jacuzzi rather than a standard shower for pre-immersion cleanliness. The mikvah itself, beneath a mosaic of blue sky and white clouds, was pristine. Cohen's eyes widened. "It's spectacular," she gasped. "I feel like I'm at the Four Seasons. You know, I've heard of other mikvahs offering chocolate-covered strawberries, you know, upon exiting, and trying to make the mikvah or offering, you know, manicurists and hairstylists, you know, available alongside the mikvah or massages." But I think this has attracted a lot of women to see the mikvah as a potential for a woman's night out, as you know, as opposed to a duty of something you have to do by way to treat herself and pamper herself. A second development of the modern mikvah experience is the ongoing effort to make the mikvah more dignified for women. To this end, Israel passed a law about a year ago under the country's privacy law, giving more autonomy to women who use the mikvah. Do you know if you're familiar with this law? Okay, so there's an excerpt from an article about it in Source 14, where it says, in a letter sent to the mikvah attendants this week, and this is again November 2013, Chief Sephardi Rabbi Yitzchak Yosef wrote that this is talking about the mikvah attendants, they can offer women assistance and explanations on matters of Jewish law, but if a woman refuses this assistance, the attendant must not interrogate and examine her against her will. It must enable her to immerse herself without any demands or interrogation, especially when this could cause the woman in question not to want to continue immersing herself next time. Chief Ashkenazi Rabbi David Lau issued a similar letter urging attendants not to be hard on women who use the mikvah. By trying to make it, I think, through classes I've given, I've also spoken to mikvah attendants and also to women about the role of the mikvah attendant and what a woman may, you know, that the duty of checking oneself before mikvah is on the woman herself, not on the mikvah attendant. And I think mikvah attendants are also being trained to be more sensitive in the way women feel, and what they do or don't say to them can really change their mikvah experience. And the alleged scandal in D.C., which I mentioned before, has really furthered the discussion on how to make the mikvah more dignified in a positive experience for women. Women mikvahs are rethinking their policies of who's in control of the mikvah, who has the keys to the mikvah, how are they run, how are women treated. And I think it's not perfect, but there's discussion about it. There's talks about it, and we're trying to make the mikvah a much more dignified and empowering experience for women. And lastly, the institution of the Yotzei Halacha program, right, run through Nishmat in Jerusalem, of which I am a graduate, has brought a new resource to our communities that allows women to feel more comfortable and empowered in keeping the laws of the mikvah. So far, Nishmat has trained about 100 women, mainly in Israel, but also in North America, who have studied the laws of nidzah and mikvah in depth and can be a resource for women in keeping the laws of mikvah. Because we know that when keeping the laws of Torah, Mishpacha, and mikvah, questions always come up. Whether it's a new birth control pill, infertility treatment, something just off this month. And many women have rabbis to whom they are comfortable turning to with their questions. And many have close relationships with their challah teachers or their rebbetzins, who they can also turn to for guidance throughout their marriage. But for others who don't have those resources, not knowing if you're keeping halachos correctly And not having a comfortable address to ask your questions can be very stressful. A woman can feel as if she's cheating the system, right, if she decides to be more lenient in a certain situation. I guess that was the right thing to do. And then she can become feel guilty and carry that guilt into the relationship with her husband. Or conversely, she can be more strict on herself, and which is probably even worse in a lot of cases, because we know that every stringency comes with a leniency, right? If you're strict about kashrut, you might end up being lenient about insulting your mother-in-law who when you say you won't eat at her home. You know, there's always going to be some sort of give and take. When you're strict in one area, you're lenient in another area. When it comes to the laws of mitzvah, being strict in the laws of mikvah can mean being lenient in the laws of shalom bayit, creating peace in the home, something that is of the utmost importance in Judaism. And there's a powerful story, this is our last source, that illustrates the importance of not being strict when it comes to the laws of mitzvah. So it says in the Mishnah, and quoted in Masechta Mitzvah and then Chet Bet, there's a story of a woman who came before Rabbi Akiva. Amra lo ra'iti ketam. She said to him, I saw a stain. Amra la shama maka haitabech. He said, is it possible that you had a wound? Amra la hein v'chaitza. She said, I did have a wound, but it healed. Amra la shama yichola v'galea lo tiyadam. Is it possible that it could reopen and bleed again? Amra la hein. She said, yes. I guess so. It's her, Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva declared her a tzahor. He sees his students looking at each other, like, what just happened? In astonishment. Why is this difficult for you? Why is the fact that I was lenient here so difficult for you? The rabbi did not declare this concept of staining to be strict. Rather, to be lenient. So, I love this story for a number of reasons, but one is that we see from here that the halachos of mitzvah are often more lenient than we think that they are. And secondly, the more knowledge you have, the more lenient you could be. Right? Rabbi Akiva was able to be a lot more lenient than his students who were not as knowledgeable as he was. Asking questions, asking us, you know, people who know more, 99% of the case leads to a situation where you could be more lenient. And the Yotzei Halacha program was created to help women keep these laws of mitzvah in a more comfortable way by training these women who could be resources and the address for women's questions. You also work with rabbis, and depending on the question, the Yotzei will either answer the question herself or refer to consult with the rabbi on the woman's behalf. Or if the woman chooses, you know, give the woman the tool, the knowledge, to ask a more informed question to her own posek. In their training, you also receive classes in women's health and sexuality, in marriage counseling. Not that we're experts in these fields, but we have some sort of working knowledge to be able to advise women in these areas, especially when they merge with halacha in certain circumstances. And the Yotzei program has offered women several ways to get their questions answered. So one is a website. If you just Google Yotzei, it will come up, where you could read articles, or you can also, there's a Ask the Yotzei feature, where you could write in an email question, and the Yotzei will write you back. There's a hotline that currently serves out of Israel, but takes questions from all over the world. And also, communities have hired Yotzei to serve as resources for the women of their community. My email and phone number on top of the, you know, the source sheet, if I could be helpful to you in any way, I'd be more than happy to. So I think these three developments, the beautification, the making the mikvah more dignified, and have also contributed to this rise of mikvah use among women to make it more user-friendly, so to speak. So as we have discussed today, the mikvah has seen a renewal in recent times. Modern mikvah users are finding new meanings that this mikvah can bring to their lives and relationships, and using the mikvah has become more comfortable, dignified, and empowering. As we have discussed the power of the waters of the mikvah, I would like to conclude the famous statement of Chazal, found in the Gemara in Baba Kama 17a, where it says, "Ein mayim ela Torah," that water refers to Torah. So just as water has the potential for rebirth and renewal, I hope the Torah learning that you engage in today offers you a fresh start to your week and renewal of your spirits. So thank you very much, and I'd be happy to take any questions you have. Yeah. Yeah. So we typically, the laws regarding the kelim are when they belonged to non-Jew beforehand, when they become in the ownership of a Jew, have to be immersed in the mikvah. Perhaps it goes back to the idea of the Avodah Zarah, or somehow, you know, if it was in a home of Avodah Zarah that, you know, use these, perhaps these vessels for inappropriate reasons, but you have to go into the home of a Jew. They first have to go into this mikvah, you know, to get rid of any sort of association it might have had. That's a good question. I'm sure there are other reasons too. Yeah, good question. She has no blood flow then. I mean, after the procedure in particular, or just throughout the rest of her marriage?
And the healing or whatever. I mean, obviously she's never going to have.
I think it would depend on the situation there. Most likely, you know, if the procedure itself engenders some sort of bleeding, she might go once, you know, after the procedure. But after that, she wouldn't have to. You know, there are a lot of women who've spoken to me about, you know, I'm postmenopausal, I'm no longer using mikvah, but I miss it in some ways. You know, like you miss the renewal, the in a relationship. So that's different. That's a different question in terms of whether she would. There's a way to allow her to go afterwards, but she doesn't have to. Yeah, I don't like it either. I would just use the translations I found, which is easily accessible. But I think that tum'ah has a very negative rap. I think because it's been translated as unclean, especially when it comes to women, like, this is natural. Why are you telling me I'm not clean? This is a natural part of women's life. And I think that, you know, I hope what I was showing today was that it's not about cleanliness. You know, either according to the Rambam, these are all natural things that happen all the time. Nothing bad or wrong about it, or associated with some sort of death or mortality. But you're right. I think it's a bad translation. So I use spiritually impure. You know, I think purity and impurity are also hard for us to relate to. I think the whole concept of something that's spiritually, that has a certain spiritual character to it that we can't see right now is hard for us to relate to, but I prefer the either spiritually unclean or spiritually impure. That way it emphasizes the fact that it's not physically unclean that we're talking about. Yeah. It's a good question. We just moved to Toronto, so it's hard. I'll speak about another, and before we came here. So I think the reaction, like, women that I've spoken to or met have only been very excited about it. And a lot of rabbis have also been very excited about it. I think for them, they realize, you know, I've gone several times to Dallas. I've gone spoken a lot in Connecticut and other communities. They realize that they're not getting enough questions when it comes to Nida. You know, like, they know that based on the women in their communities using the mikvah, and based on the questions they're getting about the mikvah, there's a lot of women not asking their questions to anybody. So I think a lot of rabbis recognize the value of this. Rish Rachli here in Shir HaShemayim, you know, recognizes the tremendous value that this could potentially add to a community. You know, I think there are, so my personal experience has only been positive, and especially women who, you know, even since I've been here, I've already gotten over a dozen questions from women in the community who, you know, haven't previously asked questions or felt they could, you know, speak to somebody about it. There are some rabbis and some women that just knew it's different and they're not so comfortable with it. I think a lot of the hesitation, I think, stems from a misconception about what the Yotzot are trying to do. I think some people feel that perhaps they're trying to replace the rabbis or go against the rabbinate or work against them. But I think if they, you know, if they actually spoke to Yotzot and learned about the program, that's not the case. They're only trying to enhance the service of the mitzvah, you know, not to take it away from the rabbis. And I'm, again, like, I'm constantly on the phone with rabbis all the time in discussing cases, questions people have. So again, I think here, now I'm actually working on, you know, making the Yotzot a little bit more official or, you know, widespread in the community. And I'm still learning the Toronto community in terms of figuring out how to go about that. But in general, I think there's a lot of excitement and understanding the value that this could really add to marriages, to women. Yeah. So currently, it's still unknown. Yeah, we're Rish Trach is very supportive of it, and we're, you know, trying to work towards something more official. But yeah, there's also another Yotze in the community, Rivka Stanenberg, yeah, who's been here for a while now. Who's also doesn't have an official role, but that might hopefully will be changing soon. We'll see. Okay. Thank you all for coming.